So, folks, this is episode 80, Practical Marijuana with Stephen Harms.
Hosting and bandwidth provided by the Blue Box Group. Check them out at bluebox.net. This episode is sponsored by JetBrains, makers of RubyMine. If you like having an IDE that provides great inline debugging tools, built-in version control, and intelligent code insight and refactorings, check out RubyMine by going to jetbrains.com/ruby. This podcast is sponsored by New Relic. To track and optimize your application's performance, go to rubyrogues.com/New Relic.
Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 80 of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel we have James Edward Gray.
Good morning, everybody.
We also have Josh Susser.
Hey, from Overcast San Francisco.
Avdi Grimm.
Hello from sunny but cold Pennsylvania.
I'm Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv, and we have a special guest, Stephen Harms.
Hi there. From it's actually sunny and warm and beach towels and bikinis in my district of San Francisco.
You're in the high rent district, right?
No, I'm just two blocks away.
So I have to ask, I know people are going to wonder, are you related in any way to Angela Harms?
No, I'm in fact no way related to any Harmses except for that are tech famous. And this Stephen Harms is certainly not tech famous. So there are no famous tech Harmses that I am aware of.
Well, I believe Angela Harms was one of our most popular episodes ever, Steve. So it's kind of something you got to live up to. No pressure.
Well, my apologies to Angela and my apologies to the Rogues for not having listened to every single podcast to have known what a great guest Angela was. So.
Wow, this guy's like really supercilious. It's great.
Josh, stop using those fancy Latin words already.
Okay, sorry.
Some of us are just super silly. Anyway.
Wait, but David's not on the show today.
I know, he's not feeling well, so we'll think positive thoughts toward Dave. So we're going to be talking about practical metaprogramming, because apparently we're doing it wrong.
But before we do that, can we talk about Parlay?
Okay.
Okay, so best thread on Ruby Rogues Parlay this week is titled Functional Programming for the Object-Oriented Programmer. But if I were to title it, I would title it Josh Susser versus the World. No, actually, it's really interesting thread. It's somebody suggested that we read Brian Merrick's book by that title and do it as an episode. And Josh came back with, well, studying functional programming hasn't been that big for me. And there was a good back and forth. And Josh kind of laid down a whole bunch of reasons why he didn't think it was valuable, and other people are laying down reasons why they do think it's valuable, and it's actually a very interesting conversation. So that's what we're up to on Parlay this week.
James, do you want to like mention what Parlay is for someone who might just be tuning in first time?
Yeah, good point. It is our Ruby Rogues mailing list where you can chat with all of us rogues, and anybody we've ever had as a guest on the show gets invited to Parlay. So all kinds of great Ruby minds sharing great ideas.
Nice. Yeah, we love Parlay and we love our Parlayists. And
is that a word?
What?
Is that a word?
Sure it is. I just made it up.
Oh, yeah, good point.
So we also have all of our guests on there. So if people have been a guest on the show, they're on the list. So we have really just a terrific list of people that discuss stuff. So anyway, now let's get to Mactical.
Mactical? What?
That is not a word. And I did not make it up. Anyway, practical metaprogramming. So we talked about metaprogramming when
was it? Episode 12. That was a long time ago.
Right. And so have things changed since then? Or did we get stuff wrong? Or is there more to talk about there? Or
actually, that's hilarious, because the reason I asked Steve to come on the show is he gave a talk at RubyConf 2011, I think, called Practical Metaprogramming, where he starts off talking about Ruby Rogues episode 12 and pretty much how bad we butchered the definition of metaprogramming. There's a great line in his thing. He goes through all the things we talked about and says, and so by this point, they've basically spent 10 minutes to not define what metaprogramming is. So, right. Steve, here's your chance. Give us the definition.
No, hold on. I want to butcher definition from Josh first.
I'd say I'm looking at the documentation here, and about 10 minutes in, it turns out that the answer to what metaprogramming wasn't was it was Lisp, or it was marshalling code closures in state, or it was ASTs versus bytecode, or it was code generation versus runtime behavior changes, which basically at that point that kind of imploded my head, and I was like, these guys aren't telling us what it is. And I thought that was kind of I was hoping to just basically leech material out of your podcast and write my slides from it, but regrettably, at least up to the first 10 minutes, I was not helped with my plagiarism in that regard.
Yeah, so Stephen, I have to agree with you that that part of the conversation was pretty messed up, and I think you know, from what I remember of it, I think we were all trying to make fine points about distinguishing what metaprogramming was compared to what a lot of people thought it was, and that that was a big mistake because we never really started with the fundamentals.
And I think now what's kind of nice is, and like James just said, is I kind of gave this talk and I was doing a lot of thinking about it around RubyConf 2011, which was September, so a little over a year ago. But I've had basically a year to kind of let those ideas marinate, and right at the kind of, as I exhaled the last breath on the talk, I kind of thought, you know, I wrote this talk wrong entirely. And I think this will be something that's kind of will hit home with kind of where the gestalt is at the moment, which is I realized I should have focused on message passing. And I'll let that just sort of sit there and let Josh do a dance of joy. But if you really think about where programming actually starts in any regard, be that metaprogramming or just regular programming, our focus should be on the messages that we need to send. And it certainly seems that Josh, I know Sandy Metz, and I saw it in Steven Ragnarok's talk at Gogoruko, is it seems like this notion about focusing on the messages that we send is now kind of becoming the starting point of where we think about programming. And I think that's kind of an interesting way to start thinking about how to program.
You know, there was a really good Ruby Tapas episode, I think it was sometime last week, where Avdi showed kind of that very concept. He started off by doing a simple metaprogramming trick, but he very intentionally bound it tightly to the methods and then went forward and showed how that caused him problems. And then he basically went back and rethought it in terms of messages as opposed to methods and showed how that basically fixed it. That was a really cool episode. I can't remember what it was called, Avdi, though, if you do.
Like methods and messages, something like that. But and thank you.
Yeah, that was the one that you had a cute trick in there for binding to a specific method on an object.
Yeah, pulling the method reference. Yeah.
Yeah, so that you could call the method rather than sending a message, and Avdi, I actually used that technique as an anti-pattern example in the talk I gave at RubyConf.
So can I stop us for a minute? Because, well, for one, he took 3 months to call us out on what we did wrong, and it took us a year to respond. But we still haven't defined what metaprogramming is.
In our defense, it takes Steve about 10 minutes to talk about how bad we did talking about metaprogramming. Just saying.
So it took us 10 minutes to not define metaprogramming, and it took him 10 minutes to define that we hadn't defined metaprogramming.
Right, exactly.
And are we about 10 minutes into the call now? Can we?
Oddly enough. How about this? I will throw a definition out there, and I will prepare myself to be savaged for this horrible definition. But I think that it's writing code that redirects a sent message at runtime. So I'm not sure I got all the right concepts there, but that's my working kind of definition.
Okay, so let's break that down. Writing code that redirects a sent message at runtime. What do you mean by redirects there? Let's talk about that.
So the redirection thing, if you watch the presentation I give it at RubyConf, I'll kind of steal my own thunder here, which is that at the end of the day, all programming, particularly in Ruby, is sending messages. And the question is, how do you catch those messages? And I've had some success explaining this to JavaScript programmers lately, by basically talking about how events bubble up a line. In Ruby, they bubble up an ancestor chain. And so the question is where you want to put that catcher. and I will give great credit to James Gray in episode 12.
I know that guy.
Indeed. Is he puts in that what I affectionately call as Gray's mandate, is he says the Ruby method call system is really important, and you have to get your head around it at some point about how it does these lookups. The method call system is a straight line with stops along the way, and once you get the hang of it, you realize you can put a module at any point on that line. So what my contention is about redirection is that you send a message out onto effectively a bus, and you just cross your fingers and hope somebody catches it. Now, the traditional way and the simple way of defining someone who will catch it is to use the def statement. So as long as you have someone on the bus, and by that I mean that kind of computer science notion of bus, as long as you have someone on the bus that can catch that message, you will not receive a no method error and you can proceed to handle it. And that gets us to the point of sort of saying, well, isn't that just programming? I think that's where the kind of dictum of metaprogramming is just programming kind of comes from, is the realization that the art of what we effectively do is designing catchers for messages that we're going to throw onto that bus.
Okay, so I think there's a lot to that, but so that's the like what is the messages thing. But I think the other half of what you said is at runtime, and so I think we can't finish this definition until we talk about what do you mean by runtime.
Right, and obviously in an interpreted language that's a little bit funny, but you know maybe this is just sort of my own personal limited cognitive faculty, but I conceive of that when I'm typing things into my editor and then I proceed to run Ruby on that stuff, I perceive that kind of being like back in the old days of compiling and linking. Is that there's something that I typed in that's being run and then being effectively auto-evaled. I think that's kind of nice. But I also recognize that there's something that happens as a sort of secondary effect where I can take the message, break it apart, reinterpret it, and then redirect it, which is kind of the basic trick of a method missing call. So I could see that kind of activity, say catching something at method missing or updating a symbol or dynamically loading in a module. I conceive of that as kind of being a separate phase of the runtime than in the sort of classical sense of, okay, I typed this into my editor and then I proceeded to run the Ruby binary against the contents of that buffer.
So I really like where you're going with this, and I think it's important. So just to reiterate, basically what you're saying is we have to think of it in terms of I'm sending this message, I'm putting this thing on the line, and it's going to start cruising down the line, but I don't really know, you know, exactly what it's going to run into at the other end. A lot of times it tends to run into def with that same name, you know, but maybe it runs into something else. But then here's my question. Given your definition, is something like a simple decorator where I just pass a class inside of another class and then, you know, do a little something extra when I intercept that message, does that qualify as metaprogramming? It seems like it does under your definition.
I suppose it does. I mean, I suppose if I'm thinking about the decorator pattern, I feel a little bit like that's more in the sense of it was composed. You're choosing to compose the class by bringing this decorator in. So, but I just recognize that the way that that's usually in Ruby, or that way that could be in Ruby, would be to dynamically pull in that module to handle a decoration. You don't necessarily have to go to a class. So I can definitely see the arguments both ways, and that's kind of what's beautiful about Ruby, is that you can see things from multiple facets. But I would argue that the heart of metaprogramming, and at least the definition that I take in the talk, is basically says that while metaprogramming is just programming, be it invoking a decorator pattern or just using sort of a mix-in, that's all very standard. But I do recognize that there's a style of programming that people sort of classically think of as metaprogramming, which usually hinges on some sort of message not being defined and handling something either via method missing or a callback. So for the purposes of didactic purposes, I frequently take on when you, I frequently understand that the person with the question is asking something focused on or centering around method missing or the dynamic construction of messages or the dynamic construction of modules. So I may have done no better at defining it, but
it's a hard thing to define. I mean, it's kind of cool.
I think there are like two categories of metaprogramming, and this may be just rephrasing what you've been talking around. And that's there's the stuff that we commonly do in Ruby, which is, you know, and at its simplest, it could be just something like putting a feature toggle kind of thing around a method definition in a class, or even like based on environment. Like, you know, if Rails.env equals production, then, you know, define the method one way, else define it another, or even just, you know, insert the method. So that sort of programmatically cobbling your program together is one level of metaprogramming. And then there's the level of metaprogramming that you see in Lisp-like languages that are homoiconic, where you can manipulate the program structures really simply as if they're, you know, just the rest of your data. And that kind of metaprogramming we don't usually do in Ruby. I mean, you know, it's not the bread and butter of Ruby metaprogramming.
No, and I'm kind of coming, you know, 1 year later, I'd say definitely with a lot of effort, Josh, on your part, and as well as with Sandy Metz's book, is I think in some cases I've seen people abuse metaprogramming to cover weaknesses in object orientation. Is people frequently kind of reach for that as a crutch, and they say, oh, well, I'm going to reach for this, and it turns out that maybe something along the lines of more subclasses or having classes that adhere more closely to the single responsibility principle might not have necessarily encouraged you to reach for some sort of method missing metaprogramming solution.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's a very good example of what you just said right there. For example, the example we hit earlier with the decorator, you know, if you really just want to add a little something to one method, it's like you say, you could define a module and then you could, you know, extend that particular module with that that particular object with that module. Or you could just build a class that takes new and saves the object reference and defines the same method and calls it normally. And you know it, in the, you know, it's the traditional way is at least as composable, right? If not more so. And to give another example, like I think we have a gross tendency to, you know, reach into a class and, you know, alias a method so we can define a new version of it so then we can call the old one or whatever. Whereas, you know, if we were a little bit better at designing our classes and we left the hooks, you know, things like observer so you could register yourself to be notified of an event when it happens, you know. It's often far superior in many ways, right?
Well, the Yehuda definitely thought so. He changed a whole bunch of the Rails internals for Rails 3 to have it be able to work that way with hooks rather than having to alias method chain everything.
Yeah, that's very true. But then if you read Sandy Metz's book, basically what Yehuda did in Rails 3 was make everything a large inheritance of modules and use super everywhere. Which is definitely better than it was. But if you read Sandy's book, she actually talks about how super is kind of another form of coupling, right? And mm-hmm. you know, sure. while better, maybe not best, you know, and that maybe it would be even better if, you know, Active Record gave us more hooks and we didn't have to insert a module. Instead, we just, you know, define the right method that it was expecting or stuff like that. So right. Kind of interesting.
Okay, here's a little side note, and you know maybe we can just spend 2 minutes talking about it. And in Ruby 2 has this new feature called module prepend. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yes.
No.
Okay. So prepend is another way to avoid having to do alias method chain, and so in Ruby previous to 2, you know the only way you can pull in modules is you include them. Well, you can extend them, but let's just talk about include, that you know, you have a class and you include it, and that makes that module an ancestor of the class. If you say, if you're in a class and you say module prepend, it sticks the module's methods into the class, but it does it below the class's own methods in the inheritance hierarchy. And that, while that's not very useful if you're writing the class itself, you can use metaprogramming to say, you know, some class, you know, send prepend with the module name, and that essentially wraps the class's methods with, you know, the methods in the module. So you can do the sort of alias method chain type behavior where you want more specialized behavior wrapping the behavior of the class. And then those things can call super to get to the class's own methods.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's great for being able to build stuff like you have to do in, you know, if you're trying to compose behavior and the author of the class didn't provide you hooks.
I think that's really interesting, particularly with the, I can say, and when I read a blog post about this, Josh, and, you know, as I was thinking about trying to extend, say, in my personal pet project, you know, trying to extend a subtype of, say, a verb, you'd want to inject that behavior as it fell into, say, one of several categories. And I realized that a lot of work that I had to do internally to make my own project work, would be just so much cleaner with the ability to pick where in that ancestor chain you inject. And I think it's going to be a very powerful thing, and I think it's going to lead to definitely some interesting code coming up as people integrate their metaprogramming designs to take advantage of module prepend.
Yeah, I think prepend was Yehuda's idea. And so, and he's done a lot of this stuff structuring modules in Rails, so I'm hoping that it will simplify stuff in that code base.
And I can tell you, as I joke with people that I run the Yehuda Cat stack, which is Janus plus Rails plus Ember. I can definitely find these patterns in the Ember framework, is that when you create a new class, you have to explicitly call super. And so I can definitely see some of Yehuda's opinions. If that's the case, it's also in Rails 3. I can definitely see a consistency of that opinion appearing both in Ember as well as in Rails.
So, Steve, we've talked a lot about defining metaprogramming, which is obviously challenging. But really in your talk, one of the things I loved was you basically just took a bunch of kind of simple principles and tried to use them to show what metaprogramming is, kind of by example, sort of. But so can you tell us, like, I think you had four things, you know, that you thought were key in understanding it. And can you kind of give us an idea of what those are?
Sure. I mean, I'd say, you know, just at the highest level, is it's absolutely imperative. And, you know, James, I'm not trying to suck up to the show host here too much, but it is absolutely critical that you do understand the inheritance chain. You know, when Josh was talking just now about module prepend, I immediately said, oh, well, let me imagine what would happen if I called ancestors on a class of an instance, you know, and I had a working model of where mixed in modules would appear in that chain. And so Josh is talking about where prepend would work in that. And I was like, oh, well, I can see that. I'd basically insert something earlier on the bus versus later. That's neat. And it's absolutely critical, really, if you want to understand metaprogramming, that you eventually evolve that notion of the ancestors chain as your conceptual model. So again, I'll give props out to Paolo Parada. His book was the one that really inspired me to do this talk. And he goes into great depth about how to build that mental model of the ancestor chain. So, you know, I'd say that as a meta tip to metaprogramming, you really want to have a worthwhile understanding of that early on. But then the second point I'd say is that once you understand that, then you want to understand this notion that you redirect messages by defining things. And as I kind of tried to start leveling people up, I kind of tried to start somewhere that was familiar, is that you can basically use def, and def is great. And def is a great way to intercept a message and respond to it. It's kind of interesting is that at RubyConf, when I asked people, I said, well, how would you redirect a message that's sent to the ancestor chain? From the audience, I got, you know, method missing, or you know, some sort of alias method chain. But everyone went out of their way to not come up with just using def. And I just want everybody to show proper respect. Def is your bread and butter for handling messages that are sent on that bus, sent on that message bus. So, you know, represent Def. You know, it's a good built-in. Yeah,
and Def with class eval is one of my favorite ways to add methods to things at runtime.
Yeah. Right. So the only case where you often find yourself in when metaprogramming that Def won't work is Def isn't a closure, right? So it doesn't have access to its surrounding environment. So if you are doing something dynamic, like saying looping over a set of variables and defining a method for each one or something, you typically need access to that outside variable. And that's where define method comes in, because the body of the method that gets defined by define method is a block, therefore is a closure, therefore has access to the surrounding.
Right. I think it's really important to understand that difference. And so with great power comes great cost. Sorry, Stephen. So the define method approach to adding methods to classes at runtime, that's great, and that gives you the closure. But because it has that closure there, it has extra cost at runtime. And there's another layer of interaction when you invoke it. So if you don't need that closure aspect of it, then your program's going to be more efficient if you don't use define method, if you just use def.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Def should be your first choice. But if you do need that surrounding scope, that's why you see people using define method, is they have to get to that variable or whatever on the outside, which is something that's, you know, not easy to do with def. You'd have to define it somewhere that would be accessible to def.
Yes. So one thing that's interesting about this that I've run into is that I was writing some integration tests for Sinatra, and the only way that I could find to basically mock out or stub out the helpers was to actually do this, where you do a class eval and then you go in and effectively redefine the methods. But one thing I realized was that it was really difficult to back it back out when I was done running the test. Is there a good kind of way to reverse doing class eval plus def or define method?
You can do undefined method.
Undef method. There's remove method and undef method, and they're different, and I have to look up why.
So if I undef it
or remove it, then the old version will come back?
It depends. If you put one in front of it, right, if you set something on the line in front of it, and you only remove that one on front, which is, I believe, the effect of remove method, it just hits the immediate method.
Undef method, actually, you know, it's almost like it actually puts a marker in that says this method doesn't exist, period.
That's right.
So it'll actually cover over something that's inherited, whereas remove method will remove the one from the current class, but it'll still reveal, and that'll just, you know, reveal any ones that are defined by parent classes. Now, Chuck, in testing, one technique that's been used, I don't know if this would have been usable in your context, but one technique that I've seen used, particularly in other languages, is rather than testing the class in question, you inherit from the class in question, and you override the stuff that you need to override in the inherited class.
Oh, there's an idea. I like
right.
that.
Right, and in the case of Sinatra, that's super easy to do if you use the Sinatra base style instead of the just normal application style where you're defining everything at the top level. The base basically wraps Sinatra inside a namespace, right?
So you just have a it's basically a test specific child class.
Right.
And you can do that up to a point, but if you have tight coupling to class names, sometimes you can't get away with subclassing.
Right. If the libraries in question use explicit class names everywhere, then you're usually up a creek, and this is yet another reason why using explicit class names everywhere isn't such a great idea.
Yeah, you know, that's a tip I actually picked up from Sandy. Was she said that at one point she said something like, the number one best thing you can do is never just hard code the name of another class inside of a class. right? That if you're going to use it, fine, but stick it in a variable somewhere so that it gets passed, so that, you know, and that variable can default to what you were going to hard code or whatever, but just so it's somewhere where you can get at it. And I've been trying to religiously follow that in the last several months, and it's amazing. Like, you can mock anything without having to actually say, hey, when he goes for this class name, replace it with this code. You know, you can just pass it into the method, you know, whatever. Yep.
So I want to kind of get into it. I have a question regarding these techniques. So if you pass in a class name or an object, you know, that you're effectively taking advantage of duck typing. It just has to respond the right way in order to be the right sort of object to do whatever needs to be done in the method. Is that metaprogramming? I mean, how far does the definition go? Because in that case, you're actually telling it, this is the thing that needs to receive the method call, as opposed to, you know, being explicit and saying, you exact class or you exact object method call.
I would argue not. I think that's, I think I said it earlier, and I don't mean to be pejorative about it, but understanding what's going on there, which is part of Sanity's excellent coverage of dependency injection, I think that's just things I wish I had known more about with respect to object orientation when I started. I think that technique that she's advocating is just good design. And I wouldn't go so far as to call that metaprogramming personally. I don't know. Maybe someone else has a contention on that.
Well, no, go ahead.
Okay. So we talked just a moment ago about don't explicitly name classes, put the class in a variable and deal with it indirectly as one way to make code more metaprogrammable. So can we look at this from other ways to make code more possible to metaprogram? What are the techniques that make your that set your code up right to have it be more metaprogrammable? And I guess there's, you know, from the perspective of okay, it's just good design, you know, how much overlap is that with just making your code generally, you know, have less coupling and be easier to refactor and just overall better designed?
I think you nailed it right there, right? It's that the less coupled objects are to each other, the easier it is to go in there and insert something at a different layer or muck around with it. So to me, that does make it more metaprogrammable. But ironically, it also means that I find myself using a heck of a lot less metaprogramming.
Exactly. Right?
Because if the objects are just loosely coupled to each other, then I don't need some clever metaprogramming trick. I just pass a different object in there that wraps the one I was messing with or whatever.
You know? Okay, so this is great because Steven started all this off by saying metaprogramming is redirecting where messages go. And if you're using good object-oriented design techniques to manipulate objects, you're doing that instead of manipulating messages.
Right.
Right.
I think that's right.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, just as a, you know, in case it's not obvious, I am completely in love with Sandy. So, you know, I'm just in awe.
Get in line, buddy.
I know. I finished her book on a week ago Tuesday. So that would have been election night, and I went to bed thinking I'm in awe of two human beings, one of whom is Nate Silver, and the second of whom is Sandy Metz. And I was just. Yeah,
we've considered changing our name to the Sandy Metz fan club.
Good, I can see why. And one of the refactoring she does in one of her videos is that, you know, she shows the. I think she basically takes, she gets a string and basically needs to run constantize on it, and you know that's a sort of a bread and butter kind of metaprogramming thing to do. But what was basically happened is that she basically had implemented a contract across several classes. And then basically, because of their duck type nature, she's just basically like, well, instead of having to type something to invoke or back into the name of the class or whatever it is, she just basically used constantize. And I was like, you know, that's just a perfect use of Ruby's awareness and introspective capabilities. And so I think, you know, when you have really good design, it turns out that the metaprogramming is there to help you type less, which is, you know, definitely what Sandy demonstrated. And I guess my kind of thought about this now is maybe metaprogramming is best when the domain has a lot of inherent instability or inherent ambiguity. And that's kind of now where I'm seeing metaprogramming reach its strong point, is that if you are to take, or is that rather, if you have solid object-oriented design principles in your application, when you hit the place where the ambiguity is such that maybe object orientation isn't going to be as easy as one might think, maybe that's the time that you can reach for that metaprogramming hammer in your toolbox.
I like that. I think that if we look at object-oriented design as a way to decrease coupling, and one way to look at decreasing coupling is it gives you more flexibility around the assumptions that you're making. That, you know, you don't have to bake everything in stone right up front. Is that if you can't if you're not achieving that decoupling by basically structuring how the objects move around your program, then you can do it by structuring how the messages flow.
Absolutely.
And okay, so where was I going with that a second ago?
Well, I was about to ask you for an example where one might be more appropriate than the other.
So here's something I think that let's see if this works. So the dynamic finders in Active Record, which have been around for a long time, where you can say, okay, user.findByEmail, and that findByEmail method doesn't exist anywhere in the code base until you try and use it. And then you can so Active Record will, you know, the first, it uses a method missing handler. You have a user object, you send it findByEmail and you pass it an email, and then there's no method there. So it used to work by just having a method missing handler that would figure out what to do. And then somewhere, I think around late Rails 2 or early Rails 3, they changed that to be, it was definitely in the like 2.x series of Rails. They changed that so that it didn't just do the work, it figured out what it had to do the work, and then generated the findByEmail method in that class, so that the next time you called it, it was already defined and you didn't have to go through the method missing mucking about.
Okay, but I love the example you just used, because it's like you said, you know, you can do findByEmail, or you can even do like findByEmail and name, right?
Yes.
And then you can pass it two parameters and stuff. So it's all this clever metaprogramming and stuff, right, to do all this stuff. So in Rails 4, they've replaced this mechanism with one stupid simple method called findby, right? And you do findby, and you pass a hash, and the key in the hash is the field, and the value in the hash is the value that you want to match, right? So email, you know, James at whatever. Right. And of course, it's a hash, so you could have multiple keys. Now you can do email and name. You kind of see, like, it was some clever bit of metaprogramming, but then they just went back and like, well, we could probably just define a method that works just as well, right?
Oh, okay. In other words, they did what they always do, and they finally got around to doing it the data mapper way.
Yes.
Sorry.
Okay. But let me finish where I was going, because I think that this is a great example that what James brought up shows, is that you know, you have the metaprogramming way of dealing with the findByEmail method on your user class, and that's great. And then you may decide, as you work with the user class, that findByEmail needs to be a little smarter than the default implementation that Active Record provides. So you can go in your user class and you can override the method definition, and you can do whatever you want in findByEmail. So, you know, maybe it maps domains for you in some weird way, or you know, what have you. But that lets you I think that's a great way to reduce coupling, where in your code you have something that is smart enough to handle the default case, but it provides a path where you can make the behavior more specific to what you need over time. And what James just mentioned, how in Rails 4 there's this one findby method that you just pass in the data, that's great, but it's really hard to override that in the same sort of specific way without tromping all over everything else.
So I totally agree with that, except for the one problem with findby, et cetera, which is that findby email and name, as a stupid example, is the same as find by name and email.
Yeah, I know.
So once you get into the ends, you know, you could get that, you could override that find by email and name, you know, and totally, and then somebody switches it around on you and they miss your optimization. So I think a better hook mechanism, I think you would have to structure the hook mechanism a little bit differently to really make that work well.
And is the fact that it's difficult to customize, is that really a fault? Like, I mean, should the class be better designed where you could hook in to how Rails does that, right? If they left you a hook method in there, then it would be easy to muck with, right?
That is absolutely true.
But hold on, before
you go there, Chuck, I just want to get back to the point I was trying to make, because, so it doesn't get lost, which is that you can use that technique of metaprogramming as a way of, when you are exploring in your code base and trying to figure out what you need, you can do something simple like that and say, oh, there's probably going to be these methods that I need, but I don't really know how to write all of them yet. So I'll just write this method missing type handler or use some other metaprogramming technique. And then once you've sorted things out, you can go back and hardwire those methods and create that functionality in a way that is maybe less flexible, but more appropriate for your more mature code base.
That's an excellent point. Yep.
One other thing that I think is interesting about the approach that you outlined there, Josh, is that they do the work kind of in the magical land where it figures out what it's supposed to do and then does it. But then it also then creates a mechanism so that the next time you do it, it does just follow the regular object model and makes it work that way.
And there's a reason the Rails team did that. It's a big performance penalty, right? This dynamic thing. So like in Ruby, the way method missing works, if you're not familiar, if you have a call stack, right, an inheritance hierarchy, basically, and you send a call, it walks all the way up the tree looking for that method. And then if it gets to the top, it goes all the way back down to the bottom looking for method missing, and it walks the tree again. So it's got to, at least by definition, be about twice as slow, right? Because...
And it's actually more like an order of magnitude or two more slow, because in the VM, you can't, when you're doing method lookup, you can cache the result, and then the VM can very quickly get to the right method, and that's pretty stable in most situations. But when you're doing the method missing handler, you actually have to execute some Ruby code in there. So you have to like break out of the VM level of operation and move up to Ruby code level of operation, and that's much slower.
So it walks that line again. So the way Rails, you know, went to doing it, where the first time it paid that penalty to hit the method missing, but after it had everything figured out, it went ahead and defined that method. So then the second time was probably quite a bit faster because it was a normal method lookup. And the third, fourth, and blah, blah, blah times were probably much faster because by then the cache probably had it, you know. So. Mm-hmm.
So I guess my question is, are there any other times that we're going to want to use metaprogramming, you know, besides maybe we have a whole possibly infinite set of methods that we don't know whether or not they're going to be called, so we're just going to handle it through metaprogramming? Are there other examples, other good places where you use these kinds of things?
Well, funny you should ask.
Tell us, Stephen.
Yes, I would argue. If you look through the slides that I gave at RubyConf, you know, there's a lovely one with the late Whitney Houston, and it says, "How will I know?"
By the way, just seeing the pictures in Steve's slides is like half the reason to watch his talk.
So. Oh, well, thanks. And if you actually watch me, I am wearing Zach Wienersmith's picture of dinosaurs extracting their revenge on meteors from his Saturday morning breakfast cereal comic. So highly recommended there. I would say that for me now, the thing that I'm kind of using to think about when I need to really reach for a lot of metaprogramming is when you have a domain which is inherently ambiguous. And I think Josh hit a really relevant use case, which is the dynamic finders in Active Record, is that, you know, find by name and email and height and lollipop preference. You know, I mean, that's really some amazing power that Rails gives you. For me, I have a certain passion around linguistics and particularly dead languages, particularly Latin. And if you think about the way, a grammatical vector is specified for a verb in Romance languages, you might say, you know, active voice, indicative mood, present tense, first person, singular, number. That's the full specification of how you specify one sort of state of this verb. But what happens if you want to chop off, say, one of those specifiers? Well, then the result set should get a little bit more ambiguous. Say, for example, in Latin, number has two possible values, you know, singular or plural. So what if you wanted to get active voice, indicative mood, present tense, first person? You leave off the number, so now you want the correct answer has two results. Or let's say you want to chop off yet another specifier in that vector. Well, now the correct answer has six possible values. And so what I kind of found in that and what Ruby allowed me to express is that this domain, depending on how precise the specification gets, the correct answer set either grows or shrinks. And so I view that as a very legitimate use of metaprogramming because the specifiers are flexible, as is the set of correct answers. And I think Josh's example around dynamic finders is the same thing. The correct answer changes on the specifiers that you provide at the time the message is passed. So for me, I think that is probably my golden rule on metaprogramming, is use a programmatic structure that tolerates ambiguity well when your domain is inherently ambiguous. So that's about as concrete as I can get about ambiguity.
I like that example because so James's response about the find by method and, oh, you could put a hook in there to be able to override it for a particular set of attributes that you're doing the find by on. You could create that hook, but it might be kind of tricky to work out what the things are you actually need to build that hook around and what the mechanism is for making that work well. The find by X dynamic finder style of metaprogramming is pretty straightforward to do that. And you don't have to think about creating this whole other mechanism. So I think that it actually is a case where metaprogramming simplifies your programming task.
Yeah, I agree. I was just pushing for more examples because it seems like yours was a pretty specific example of maybe a broader case, and I think Stephen explained that pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. To give a simple, broad example that probably most of our audience is familiar with along the lines of Steve's example, you know, active record itself, when it makes an object, you know, it has several methods that are backed by fields in the database, right? Now, the interesting question in both that example and Steve's is, could those methods be defined up front? You know, could you run a loop that sets all those methods out? But what are the downsides of doing something like that? You know, so it's an interesting question, I think.
Yeah, I think it depends on the trade-offs and how you're using whatever it is. But yeah, it's definitely something that is worth exploring. We're running out of time. Are there any other practical metaprogramming things we should cover before we wrap up?
I'm going to mock out the time object so that we can allocate a few more minutes here in the call.
Okay.
You can do that.
Well done.
Yeah. As long as he doesn't have to touch time zones.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, way to rub lemon juice into that wound, Chuck.
What wound? That was my crowning achievement of Twitter.
Yeah, how's your Twitter client working out?
No, I discovered recently that having a very popular tweet can break Twitter, and that everybody in the world thought it was good to reply to my tweet, and then I couldn't find any at replies to me that I actually cared about. Now I know what it's like to be a celebrity for 5 minutes.
Yeah, you don't care about what anyone's saying to you.
Well, a lot of people reminded me that in addition to hating time zones, I should also hate daylight saving time and character encodings.
Yeah, I saw that.
Anyway, enough about that. What were we talking about with metaprogramming?
Charles was saying,
I don't know, but you were mocking the time object.
Oh, right, mocking the time object. We're running out of time. Mocking time, yeah. I guess that's all I have to say about it. Moving right along. See what happens when I when I'm not drinking coffee, right?
Steven, were you in the middle of a list of the things that characterize?
Yeah, that's true. I think we did cut him off mid-list.
I don't think I was characterizing. I think James had asked,
or not characterizing, but like four things.
Or a process of moving on is well, one, you can look at the slides, so they are actually very digestible. But if we were to try to run through them, what I kind of called, you know, how to level up in metaprogramming, you're going to start with understanding things like the open class. In particular, the kernel method and the monkey patch. You're going to you need to understand how the adder methods work, and then you need to understand how alias works. Basically, how you can alias a method. This plus the understanding of the ancestors chain. That's what I call tier one, and that's enough to let you paint yourself into a corner. And I think that's where podcasts like this and where just some exposure will help you decide whether or not metaprogramming is warranted. You know, choosing between defined method and just, you know, using plain old def. And then, but I definitely say that the route to making sure that you have a good understanding of metaprogramming is understanding what the singleton module, or excuse me, what the singleton class is, and understanding the ancestors call. And as you move on, I'd say that the second tier is basically where you start integrating those first tier techniques, and also where you start rolling object send in more and more often is where you're more comfortable with catching a message and then sending it to the object, as well as sort of the glittering diamond in the crown of metaprogramming, which is making use of the method missing call. And I think that's probably once you, I'd say that's all, those are all of the techniques.
Steven, I want to add one more technique in there because I think it's really important, and I want Avdi to tell us about it.
Oh, okay.
Uh-oh.
Avdi, this is your rule that when you're adding methods to objects, you should always put them in a module.
Well, I figured Steven was probably going to get to that one next.
Oh, I thought
at another level.
I thought okay. Steven was done.
Oh, is he?
Sorry. Okay.
But I actually totally stole that technique from Avdi, so I do think he should definitely talk about it. I do recognize that as you're kind of moving on into the stratosphere of metaprogramming, you need to start thinking about basically the no-holds-barred technique, which would be class eval and instance eval. And then from there on, you're pretty much free. I would say you probably have the techniques under your belt to implement the metaprogramming style of programming. But at this point, you really need to think about how to do it responsibly, because if you are writing this code and some other human, if only your future self is going to see it, you need to think about responsibility. I think that's where you need to think about understanding response to and respond to missing, which James just recently, and it's just both of those are just such beautiful methods. Respond to missing, I did a refactor on one of my classes, and I just cut out so much code that I was trying to handle and respond to. But thanks to respond to missing, it's amazing how much code that can save you if you're writing a programmatic idiom. And with that, I would like to segue with Avdi's excellent observation about why you should put your it's why you should grow what is it? I guess you should grow received messages by putting them into a module or
something like that. Yeah. Well, let me first say that the using the respond to missing. I think I haven't finished the talk where they talk about this, but I think that's one of the things that Jim Wyrick refers to as polite metaprogramming.
Absolutely correct. Yes.
You know, where you not only respond, you know, you not only implement missing method to respond to some random method, but you also let other folks know that you're going to be, that you can respond to that by implementing respond to missing. And the cool thing about respond to missing is that you can reuse that in your method missing. And so you can dry up your test to see whether you can handle a given message.
There's another cool thing about respond to missing, just because in case we haven't sold it yet, if you implement respond to missing, then it makes more of Ruby's object system work with those imaginary methods that you're handling through method missing. For example, you can now use things like method to get a reference to them, which you can't normally do, but Ruby knows it's there because it calls respond to missing to see if you're going to handle it, and because you are, it makes like a fake proxy method on top of it and does method.
Yeah. So as far as modules go, you know, if you're going to write your own version of At Your Reader or At Your Writer, maybe you're like writing an At Your Reader that also has a default value or something like that. You know, the first thing you might turn to is like a defined method or a class eval or something like that, you know, that evals in a new method. And of course, what that's going to do is that's going to put the method right there in the class where you said At Your Reader or, you know, my At Your Reader. And that means that if somebody wants to, you know, in their class where they use that, if they want to slightly modify, maybe they want to put like a little bit of extra layer, maybe like a caching layer or some kind of validation layer on top of that Azure accessor or something, they're basically going to have to rewrite your code because as soon as they define the same method, your method is lost. So they're either going to have to do some fancy alias footwork or some fancy save that method object and then reuse it footwork or something like that. Whereas if you as the metaprogrammer implement that that special At Your Reader or special At Your Accessor to generate a dynamic module, generate a module at runtime and insert the generated method into that, you know, put the generated method into that module and then insert the module into the class that's being extended. Now you've inserted it into that wonderful ancestor chain, and all you have to do, and so if somebody wants to do a customized version of your method, they can just write their own and call super to go back to your definition of it. You know, they can reuse your definition very easily with super. So that's why modules are good.
So just to explain that another way, right? If we've been talking about the class lookup call as a line, and there's various points on that line where your message can stop, then if you do something like, you know, class eval and shove your code into the same space, you're trying to squeeze multiple things into just one of those points on the line, right? Whereas right. It's better to take two points on the line, cut the distance in half, and put something there, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I need to get you to start, like, drawing pictures for my Ruby Tapas episodes.
Nice. Yeah, well, so we had this conversation a while ago on Rogues about the putting methods in modules to metaprogram them in. And then I went back and I added that to active record associations so that you can do the super trick with them.
Thank you. I actually use that in active records now. So
yeah, I do too, amazingly enough. So much more useful than I expected.
All right. Well, I think we're out of time. Really appreciate you coming on the show, Stephen. And this has been an excellent episode. This is one of the ones where I'm probably going to have to go listen again just to make sure I understood everything that was talked about.
I know I will.
So,
and from now on, when we get stuck on a definition, we'll just make a call out to Steven. So.
Yeah, there we go. Steven.define.
Right. Ooh, a delegator. I like it.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the picks. James, what are your picks?
Okay. I just have two quick picks this time. The first one, tech-related pick, is this cool library I found recently called Hamster. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but it's basically like various Ruby data structures, but they're immutable and thread-safe and all of that. So very interesting. It has things like hash, set, list, stack, queue, vector. And like I said, all of them immutable. So that's pretty interesting stuff if you enjoy that style of programming. I've been looking at that more since we read Goose, and it talks about keeping the low-level data structures immutable, which is not something you typically see with like hashes and things like that. So this library is kind of interesting for that. And then for a non-programming pick, I have been using iTunes Match recently. That's Apple's new music service. It's pretty cool. I like it. You basically pay them a fee. It's like $25 a year. It's ridiculously cheap, in my opinion. And they just match your music library based on what they have in the iTunes music store. So they have a ton of music, and so that just means most of your music is just basically instantly there. And then anything that doesn't match, they just upload. And there is an upload limit, but I was way under it. I think it's like 25,000 songs, but there were only like 1,000 of my songs that didn't just match right off the store. So anyways, then your entire library is in the cloud, either because it was matched or because it was uploaded. And anything that Apple matched, they upgraded to their best encoding they had. And so even if you had, you know, an old MP3 you ripped off a CD or whatever, you now have the best that the iTunes store has to offer of the same song. And then you can set your devices where they just stream music from the cloud. So it's kind of awesome if you have like a computer and a, you know, iPhone and an iPad and all that, because you can share, you know, the same music everywhere. And if you need it not to stream for some reason, there's download buttons so you can download an entire artist or an entire playlist or whatever if you know you're going to be off the grid for a while or something. Anyways, it's a neat service and I've been enjoying it, so you might want to check that out. Those are my picks.
So does anyone remember like a decade ago when mp3.com got sued out of existence for offering the exact same service?
No, I guess not.
I'm not shocked.
Well, did mp3.com work out all the licensing deals with the music labels?
No, because you couldn't do that back then, because the music labels just thought that mp3 was another word for piracy back then.
Yeah, I know. It's just nuts how they don't figure out that the
feature. Yeah, I think they called it like Backpack or something like that. It would, you know, it would do the same thing. Go through your library and it would match the ones that were already on, you know, that they already had in their server farm, and then you could stream your whole library.
Yeah, it's like the future is barreling down on the music industry like a runaway train, and they're like standing there with flags trying to get it to slow down.
Yeah, they've been seriously scary behind the times.
What's that quote by William Gibson? The future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like Hollywood has been steadily refusing the distribution of the future for, I mean, gosh, you know, Napster was around when I was in college. So, you know, yeah, it's hard to believe that it's taken a number of years for them to actually get the message that evolve or die. So
yeah. I'm just wondering how many of those record labels Apple negotiated with a 2x4 to the face, because... And honestly, the ones that they had to, I'd just be like, dude, hit them harder.
Right.
Knock some sense into them.
Apparently, they used Scott Forstall for those jobs.
All right. Avdi, what are your picks?
Well, let's see. A book pick, Rebuilding Rails by Noah Gibbs. If you've ever wanted to understand the internals of Rails better, this is a good place to start, because basically you go through and rewrite your own version of Rails, and you know, it's a simplified version of Rails, but you will learn basically how it works, and you know, how the router works, and how, you know, controllers work together with views and stuff like that, and you learn it by rewriting it yourself. So I recommend that. And for a non-programming pick, Aardman Animations Limited, otherwise known as Aardman Studios. You may know these folks as the creators of Wallace and Gromit. They've done some movies as well, and they've got a couple of shows of their wonderful claymation on Netflix now. There's Shaun of the Sheep, and there's a spinoff now for even younger kids called Timmy Time. And the thing that I love about these people, they do these claymation shows, and unlike so many other children's programs, they have resisted the trend of converting a perfectly good claymation show to soulless CGI. You know, they're still doing stop motion, and they just have this great style to them. And their children's programs are the kind of children's programs that you can put on and not want to claw your eyes out if you're in the same room with it. So, yeah, our household has benefited from their stuff, because it's like, sure, put on some Shaun of the Sheep. Nobody minds Shaun of the Sheep.
Yep. All right, Josh, what are your picks?
Okay, let's see. I have two video picks from the recent RubyConf, and one of them is a gamble. Sarah May's keynote video has not been published. But Sarah May did a keynote. By the way, I believe she's the first woman ever to keynote at a Ruby conference. Only took 11 years. Yeah.
Oh, so wait. Sorry, that was depressing.
Yeah. progress, yay. Okay, so she did a talk called An Insufficiency of Good Design that really got people in the conference talking. And it was really about the interaction between how you structure your teams of people who work on software and what that does to the nature of the software itself. So that was a really great talk. And then the other talk that I really liked. I mean, there were a lot of good talks at RubyConf, but I think maybe the most important talk of the entire conference was Brian Ford gave a talk called Towards a Design for Ruby, where he talks mainly about the political situation of all the different Ruby implementations and the kind of the process by which the Ruby language design moves forward. And it's just a half hour or so talk, I guess 45 minutes, something like that. And it's really worth watching if you feel like you have a stake in the future of Ruby.
And only if you have a stake in the future of Ruby.
If you don't care about the future of Ruby, don't bother watching it. That's all I'll say.
Well, geez, I'm hanging up on this call right now.
That's it for video picks. And then I have a fun pick. So Rick Olson, Technoweenie, turned me on to a comic book a couple years ago called Powers. And it's by, Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Avon Oeming. And these guys used to be comic book artists, I think it was at Marvel, and they've done some fairly high-profile work there. But they wanted to write hard-boiled detective murder mysteries involving superheroes, and you can't do that in Marvel because you can't really run around killing off Spider-Man. People will get upset. So they created a whole new comic book universe where they can kill off people and then have murder mystery detective stories about it. And it's like the best superhero comic book that I've read since The Authority came out. So the reason I'm picking it now is because they have like 15 graphic novel compilations of the series as it existed a couple years ago. And I just read that they're going to be restarting the series. They're going to be rebooting it and continuing on the storyline. So I'm going back and rereading the old stories so that I can get myself caught up again. And I just love them. They're really good. They're very mature. They use strong language. There's, it's definitely an R-rated comic. So it's not the kind of thing you should share with your kids. But if you're an adult connoisseur of comic books, I highly recommend it.
Awesome.
And that's it for me.
Steven, what are your picks?
Well, as David is feeling ill, I was told I could get some extra picks. So I will toss a few of those in there. The first one I'd like to say is that we just, at my company, if I may slightly shill ever so slightly, I work at shopitome.com. So A, we're hiring. So that's why I'm doing this. And B, we have a lot of interesting data about people and their retail habits. And we're a Rails and Ember.js shop. And I am told by Yehuda and Tom that we're one of the largest implementations of Ember. So it's been a lot of fun to work on, and I think there's a lot of great design direction behind Ember. So if you're looking for a JavaScript framework for thinking about how to build applications, not how to build a single page app or an app Ito or some tiny app, but you're thinking about how to build JavaScript applications that work online and offline, I highly recommend Ember.js and its associated data. So that's my number one pick. I really do like Ember quite a lot. For some fun sort of programming tools that I've seen, my boss, so here I am sucking up again, is actually working on a thing called Faster Ack, which uses Go and Go routines to basically consistently index and create something like a C tags repository so that you can basically browse your code very, very quickly. And I'll provide a link for that below. I also recommend a tool that I wrote called GIFL, which is Google I'm Feeling Lucky. So if you're writing Markdown and you need to get a link from I'm Feeling Lucky, this is basically something I stole from TextMate, look at GIFL. It's a simple little plugin that will allow you to go out and feel lucky and get those links and inject them in Markdown, and it just makes life a lot easier. And then lastly, I'd like to maybe pitch a thing that's kind of also fun, but I also think has a moral cause behind it, which is social engagement, which is as programmers, we do a lot of things alone in dark rooms. And I would encourage everyone listening to just try doing something social. I've been reading a lot about urban design and theories of community. And there used to be this notion called a third place, which was not home, but which was not work, where people went and they had a rich social life. So here, thankfully, in San Francisco and the greater Bay Area, you can actually pursue swing dancing. That's just my personal third place. I go out usually twice a week and see live music and meet my friends out in this third place. And I think that's a really valuable thing. So get out and meet people and have social interaction. And kind of associated to that, I'm going to preach here, which is that I believe that rationalists and secularists have a moral obligation to donate and or be involved in civic or intellectual institutions. So go see an opera, go to a museum, or fund somebody. You don't have to be at that Bruce Wayne level of being socially involved to have an impact. But if you think about in the Gilded Age of America, say the earliest 20th century, we built these wonderful social institutions which were meant to spread the profusion of learning and rational thought, knowledge, and appreciation of the sublime. And we're not doing that as much as we used to anymore, in part because it's harder to concentrate wealth like you used to in the era of the Carnegies and Standard Oil and whatnot. But just at a personal level, you should be engaged with your arts, because the people who believe in irrational behavior are funding irrational institutions, you know, Al-Qaeda being a notable one. So I highly recommend that you be engaged with rational, tolerant, accepting, and enlightened social institutions. So that's just my pitch on that.
All right. Well, I guess I'm going last. So I have two picks. The first one is something that I picked up when I was getting started with Ruby, and it really helped me understand a lot of the things that we talked about here today, and that is Dave Thomas's videos, the Ruby Object Model and Metaprogramming. He did this quite a while ago. I think it's based on like Ruby 1.8 dot something, but the concepts are still relevant, and it really helps you get a good idea of what's going on under the hood with a lot of the stuff that we talked about. The other pick that I have is I'm going to be speaking at New Media Expo. I'm going to be on the podcasting track. And if you're interested in blogging, podcasting, or anything like that, I highly encourage you to come out. I'm going to put an affiliate link on the website so that if you want to go, you can just click on it and you know, get a little commission for that. But anyway, either way, just you know, if you're trying to build that audience or figure out some of the social media stuff, then this is definitely a great way to go. So those are my picks, and we'll go ahead and wrap up the show. Are there any other announcements we want to go over before we end the show?
Thanks, Steve, for coming on.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's been a dream, and I really enjoyed talking with you fine folks. So hopefully other listeners will find this enlightening, and feel free to reach out to me, GitHub, Twitter, whatever it is, if you want to take me to task for my shoddy definition of metaprogramming.
Yeah, it should be an interesting conversation, because I think everybody comes at it a little differently, and so understanding some of the magic will, I think, help everybody be better at that kind of design in their code. So all right, well, let's call it a show and get back to work, I guess.
Goodbye, internet.
That's all. Bye. Folks.